You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Back to another episode of the Van Flip Podcast. I'm your host, Lurk. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking out the podcast. If you've been here before, welcome back. We appreciate you checking it out again. If you are listening to us on a platform where you can rate and review, we ask that you please do so. It helps us out greatly in the podcast algorithm world. And make sure you check out lambgoat.com to stay up to date on news, releases, and announcements from around the hardcore and metal world. You can go ahead and follow Lambgoat on social media, give us a like on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Lambgoat. We also started a Twitter account for the podcast. Go follow at VanFlip Podcast. Give us a tweet right now and let us know that you're listening to the podcast, or tell us who we should have on next. If you are interested in watching podcasts instead of listening, all of our episodes are available to watch on the Lambgoat YouTube channel. Head over there, hit the subscribe button, hit the notification bell so you're notified on each and every release that we do. At this time, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Dylan, Lachlan, Chris, and Jeff. Thanks for the support. You guys rock. You guys are awesome. We wouldn't be here without you. If you yourself would like to become a Patreon supporter, not only do you help improve the podcast and the show, but you also get early access to episodes before they are released, an invite to our private Discord chat, some Lambgoat swag, and more. We will even shout you out on the podcast for as long as you are a supporter. Visit patreon.com/thevanflip for more info. In this episode, Alex joins me for a stroll down memory lane with Josh, ex-Trustkill Records owner and now owner of Bullet Tooth Records.
Oh yeah, what's this? I feel this. Oh yeah, this is Oh no. Oh no, no, no!
Lambgoat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
Welcome back to the Van Flip Podcast. This week, Alex is joining me again for the quarantine special. We have Josh, who is the current record label head of Bullet Tooth, but you may better know him as the owner of Trustkill Records, a very prominent hardcore label in the 90s and 2000s. So welcome to the show, Josh.
How you doing? It's like to be here. Nice to, thanks for having me.
More than welcome.
What's up, Alex?
Hey, man. I think, let's see, I met you once, and that was circa 2000 and... Shit, when was that? I'd say 2004 or something?
Oh, earlier than that.
Maybe, yeah.
It was like 2000... 2000 or 2001, I want to say. It was a show in Philly.
Yeah, some house show.
Walls of Jericho. It's some shit.
From Autumn to Ashes.
Yeah.
And somebody, well, actually there were a bunch of bands. I don't know. I didn't end up staying for the whole thing. I got like a parking ticket and I went out to, I forget what happened, but you know, because that was 20 years ago or whatever. But what I did see was pretty cool. But yeah, that was one time I met you. I think I met Carl Severson of Ferret fame. Yeah. And
he was at that show as well.
John Wiley of Eulogy. Yeah. And the now infamous Alan Landsman.
Mean Pete was there.
Wow.
Was he? See, I didn't talk to him.
Where was this again? Where? What location?
Was this at the Stalag?
That doesn't ring a bell. I'd probably know the name if I heard it, but
yeah, it was.
It was just different. It was a house, Dave, and like
where was the house? What city?
It was a veritable house. Well, it was closer to Upper Darby, which like northeast Philly, northwest. I don't freaking know.
House show, huh? House shows with all those bands. Good lord, that's crazy.
Well, this was just around that time. From Autumn to Ashes was just blowing up. And it was before they hit their peak, so yeah, I don't freaking know. I didn't go to a lot of shows at houses ever. Although you're talking to Mr. House Show right here, so I guess that's kind of where you got your start, sort of, right?
Used to kind of, yeah.
Gravel Basement was like
early
the
90s.
Venue.
Yeah, so I went to school, went away to college in 92. Came back home for the summer in 93 and started doing shows in my parents' basement and did them from 93 to 95. And I'm actually sitting in that basement right now.
That was my next question. I was wondering if this is the infamous basement.
Yeah, this is. So 2 years ago, I bought my parents' house and where I grew up and where I had all those shows. So it's pretty exciting to be back. Nice. And I'm like, you know, doing laundry in the basement in the same room where we
played. Those walls could talk.
And
are those the same walls?
Same walls, yeah. Man, they can talk. Yeah.
Those walls are still intact after what? Earth Crisis, Snapcase.
So many bands. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was 19 years old. I came home from my first summer, and I'm like, hey, Mom and Dad, can I have some hardcore bands play in the basement? And they were like, all right, why not? The basement, you know, is a piece of shit. All the ceiling tiles were falling down and the floor was all smashed up and it didn't really matter. So, but yeah, I had 20, 30 shows over the course of 2 or 3 years. And then in the late 90s, my parents, finally finished the basement and made it look nice. So now it's pretty decent. Now, if like my kid in like 12 years asked me to have bands play down here, I'd be like, hell no. Yeah. Because now it's my house.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that. My parents live in a house that's like 120 years old, and the basement is like a bunker of concrete, so that wouldn't work. But
this house was built in 1960, and there's been a lot of issues and flooding and all kinds of stuff. But you know, we've slowly but surely. Getting it back into place.
You have an ample amount of parking then, I take it.
It's at a dead end. It's in a cul-de-sac, which helps. And it's in the burbs. And I think, like, you know, I had a lot of shows and there were a lot of kids at these shows. I mean, one or two of them, they were probably 150, 200 kids, I want to say. But I feel like everyone was like really skinny back then, so they fit in the basement equally.
Yeah.
And I feel like also, you know, we were young and like everyone was carpooling, so I don't think like the neighborhood filled up with cars by any means, but I don't know. No one ever really complained.
Oh, that's cool.
That's interesting.
I mean, I had beer parties with 100 or 200 people, but my parents were like in a different country. They would have never not only concerts, but just this music, hardcore, punk, whatever you want to call it, that would have revolted them, I think.
Funny story. One show, it was Split Lip, Ashes were on tour together, and I put them on a bill with a bunch of other bands, and you know, my parents were here in the house when I would have shows and they didn't really mind. but that Split Lip Ashes show, those bands got stuck somewhere like in Connecticut or something. I forget. And they called and they were like, hey, you know, we can show up, but we're going to be like 4 hours late. We're not going to get there to like midnight. They're like, is that cool? Like, should we still show up? Is there going to be people there? Can we still play? And I was like, yeah, why not? It doesn't really bother me. Like, kids will hang around. Like the shows here were more like, it was more like a, not like a party vibe, but more like a hangout vibe. But I had like maybe like three bands play, and then literally everyone just hung out for 3 hours, and like around midnight, Split Lip and Ashes showed up and they played and it was awesome, and there were 100 kids in the basement screaming their heads off, and I thought for sure my mom was gonna kill me in the morning. Because the bands were playing to like 2 a.m. and their bedroom is right above where the bands play. And the next morning I saw my mom and I was like, I'm really sorry. And she goes, for what? And I was like, well, there are bands playing at like 2 a.m. And then she was like, oh, your father and I slept right through it, I guess. I had no
idea. Must have some thick ceilings or walls.
I don't know. We don't, but I think also like all the bodies in the basement kind of muffled the sound a bit. So who knows?
Hey, once you're asleep, you're asleep, you know?
That could be. Yeah.
You got cool parents, I'll say that.
I do, yeah. Very.
You cool. Got your dad who recently passed away. Our condolences. But your dad was a doctor. Your mom was a lawyer, right?
She is, yep. She's so still pregnant.
Oh, she's still okay. So you had like the Cosby Show thing going on.
I kind of did, and I have three older sisters.
Oh, wow. And yeah. Your names were Vanessa and
yeah,
whoever the others were, Denise.
Yeah, I got the Cosby joke when I was a little kid, of course.
Yeah, sorry about that. That's the first thing I think of when a doctor and a lawyer are married.
Yeah. So my mom was 19. She was a high school dropout in a biker gang in Brooklyn.
Hell yeah.
And met my dad. He was 29, just got home from medical school in Switzerland. And they met in the Poconos at one of those like Jewish retreats that you learn about watching Mrs. DeMazel. And they met. And they were married 6 months later, and years later, she went and got her GED, then she went to law school while she had four kids, and eventually, yeah, started practicing law.
Crazy.
That's awesome. And props for mentioning the Poconos.
Yeah.
I think my parents honeymooned there because they had no money, but later in life, they bought a vacation home there, and I spent like 5 years of my life going to the Poconos every single freaking weekend to ski.
That's awesome.
And play tennis in the summer. I kind of miss it, but I didn't like it at the time. But in any case, I never thought the Poconos would be getting mentioned here, so that's cool.
Yeah.
And you went to, correct me if I'm wrong, I have this vague recollection that you went to law school or you started to.
Yeah, I went to law school at Syracuse, and I graduated in 2001 and had a clerkship lined up with a judge here in Monmouth County in Freehold, Judge Lair, and I was really excited about it. And I had, you know, I'd started my record label when I was in college and never intended it to be a job or a career or to pay the bills. It was just for fun. And then I took 2 years off after college and I went on tour with my bands and I went back to school, to law school, ran the label all through school. And by the time I graduated, I realized, I mean, this was in 2001, but I'd already had a bunch of bands that were selling records and some kind of exciting stuff was going on.
That's when Trust Kill just,
It was really starting to pop. And I got a letter from the judge and it was just, you know, just outlining, you know, what was going to happen when the clerkship was starting and what my duties were. And I was reading it and I was just like, man, like, you know, when I was in law school, I could easily like skip a class if I had to, or, you know, work till 4 in the morning if I had to, or, you know, whatever. I just, you know, budgeted my time and got things done. But clerking for a judge, you know, that would have been 9-10 hours a day working for a judge and not being able to, you know, work on albums and tours and just everything I was doing with Trust Kill at the time. And so I called my judge and I passed on the clerkship and he was kind of shocked.
You're making a mistake, son.
A year later, I signed a big distribution deal with Red, and it was awesome, and I'm glad I did that. And
I don't know, man, you should have signed with Lumberjack.
I don't have any regrets. Well, I did sign with Lumberjack.
Oh, my
four years,
sorry.
4 years prior. No, actually, I signed with Lumberjack when they started. Lumberjack started with Trustkill.
Oh, and, okay.
So Trustkill was part of the original, I think it was 8 labels. But when Eric Astor from Art Monk started Lumberjack, it was like the 8 exclusive Lumberjack labels. I think it was Trustkill, Art Monk, Gern Blandston, Doghouse, and a couple others. I forget. But yeah, and then he ended up selling it to Dirk from Doghouse. And then I left, and yeah.
How did Mortem group? Wasn't there a Mortem?
So Mortem was like a separate thing in the 90s.
Explain what Mortem is and for those who don't know.
Mortem was a distribution company, like Lumberjack. And then they were actually around before Lumberjack. And then those companies merged at some point, and I think Dirk bought Mortem. And then I'm not really sure what happened after that.
Sorry, Dave. I didn't mean to send us down this road.
You're good.
But yeah.
You're
Lumberjack was a distribution company, but
those are for the most part, but
they were like the hardcore kind of, you know, our little corner of the world, the distribution for.
I remember a bunch of labels, and I remember Red when Trustkill started doing it through Red. So that's how I knew both of those. But I didn't know if you were talking about if Mortem was a band or a guy.
What happened? I think at some point. Well, actually, the two records that I put out with Lambgoat were Lumberjack, Mortem, because there was some partnership or purchase. I don't know the details, but right around the time I did that, I started getting warnings about that company. Sounds of the Underground, I was in some back room that I don't know what. I drank a lot that day, I don't remember, but I ended up next to Jake Bannon from Converge, and we were talking. He's like, they owe me $30,000 and they suck and blah blah blah, and I had just put out like an album with them, and then like 2 years later they closed up shop, and they totally screwed everything up.
3 years before that, back to 2002, I had been with Lumberjack for like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years by that point. And that record behind you, I had just put out, Poison the Well, Tear from the Red. I believe that was the last album I put out through Lumberjack. And I just looked at an email a couple of days ago. I was digging through something and, so it was 2002, and Lumberjack were handling all the pre-orders for the Tear from the Red record and all the retail and basically everything. And, you know, there wasn't any back-end way for me to, like, see how many were selling or where they were going. So I just have to email them and be like, hey, what's going on? So I sent him an email, and I said, hey, how's the Poison the Well record going? Are we getting pre-orders, or, you know, what's going on? And the email I got back from them was basically this like snotty, annoyed email basically saying, we're so fucking overwhelmed from your record that I don't know, but we'll get back to you at some point, because it was some woman, and she's like, I'm so busy packing up your records that I can't even find out that information for you. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound right. I was like, I
guess that's a good news, bad news thing.
It's a good news, bad news, but that was pretty much the end for me. And then, you know, 6 months later, I went to Sony, and then I ended up having to sue Lumberjack to get the $300,000 or $400,000 they still owed me that they decided they just didn't want to pay me.
So you guys have both kind of had the situation.
Basically, every label that was with Lumberjack at that point in the early mid 2000s, we all had to sue and settle out, and it was a big disaster. But, you know, luckily I got to a company that could handle big records, and we moved on.
So there's a couple things I know that me and Alex have for you specifically, but before we get like super into that, for those who don't really know or are too young to really remember, explain how, like, what Trustkill was and like the bands that you guys had on your earlier rosters. You know, because to me, there's a handful of labels. We've already mentioned most of them already in this podcast, but you guys were like the cornerstone for like all the hardcore metalcore, metal stuff, you know, that I could find outside of, you know, whatever was on the radio or the TV, which is very borderline underground per se. So just kind of like
TV hardcore.
That's what I'm saying. Like MTV2 at some point when Trustkill was around, they also had videos, but you know, you guys were already out for a while before that happened. So,
yeah,
just like explain how you, you know, like the whole situation with Trusco, like getting it. I mean, you already described how you got it together, but like, you know, what it was.
How did it blow up?
Yeah.
Blow up, man. I mean, I'm too close to it to ever feel that it like blew up, but you know, I was just trying to like keep all the plates spinning and, you know, working for the bands I'd signed and, you know, trying to, you know, build careers.
Can we agree that probably the catalyst for the explosion, and I realize you didn't see it as an explosion, but perhaps from an outsider's perspective, the catalyst, as I see it, was The Opposite of December by Poison the Well.
Yeah, I would say that was a big turning point. That came out right at the end of 99, early 2000. So I was in law school. It was my second year of law school, and I signed Poison the Well, 18 Visions, and Walls of Jericho in the same month.
Yeah, all three big bands from back in the day.
Really, but at the time, to me, it didn't seem big. I mean,
I guess yeah, they weren't big then.
They weren't big. I mean, you know, Walls of Jericho had a record out on Gennett.
Remember them vaguely.
And then 18 Visions had their record out on Life Sentence. And Poison the Well had a record out on Good Life. So yes, I signed
this
off.
This one. Where is it?
Yeah.
This one.
Which one?
He's pointing to a bunch
distance,
of...
Distance Only Makes the Heart Grow Fonder.
Oh, that one, yeah. That one.
Pointing to posters behind him.
Yeah, I can't see what's behind
him. So then in 99, so early 2000, it was like boom, boom, boom. Poison the Well, 18 Visions, Walls of Jericho, trying to think what else came out around that time. I was also heavily involved in doing Hellfest. So I got involved with Hellfest in 98 and then 99. And then 2000 was really like Hellfest 2000, I think, was like kind of like the pinnacle turn where we were like, oh shit, this is a big deal. Like, people were flying in from Europe and South America and Japan, and Poison the Well showed up and played songs from The Opposite of December and just blew the roof off. Like, it was funny. I remember standing there on stage with Steve Reddy from Equal Vision, and they're on like their second or third song, and the sing-alongs were just insane. I mean, it was deafening. And Steve Reddy elbows me and he goes, "Man, how many records have you sold of theirs?" And I was like, "Not that many," because I remember that the response and the reaction was way bigger than record sales, because at that moment it was when Napster really hit.
I was gonna say file sharing was a big thing right then.
That file sharing just exploded, and yeah, I mean that was really it. People just really knew the band. They knew the songs. They didn't necessarily buy the record. But, you know, sales picked up, of course. And then, yeah. I would agree. Opposite of December, then right into Until the Ink Runs Out from 18 Visions, Bound Feed to Gag from Walls of Jericho.
There's a couple of Throwdown records in there, early Throwdown records.
So then Throwdown I signed a little later. That wasn't.
Hey, you did the artwork for that Until the record, didn't you?
I did the artwork for almost all my records.
Hey, you didn't do The Opposite of December, man.
I didn't. Oh wait,
that was Bannon, wasn't it?
It was.
No, I don't think it was him. I think we talked about it with Chris. It was someone else, maybe.
No. Jake Bannon for sure did the artwork for it, but I may have laid it out. So like, he did the artwork, and then just like. Okay. Gave it to me, and
I guess I can look at the credit, but I'm pretty sure it was Bannon who did the artwork, but he didn't lay it out.
Bannon is like mostly responsible for that record. Until the Ink Runs Out, I forget who sent me that artwork of like the moth and the paint and But I got all that, and yeah, I just took that and turned it into some layout. I did the same thing with the Walls of Jericho, and I mean, pretty much everything from back then. I didn't really like hire an artist until 2005, I want to say. But yeah, that was definitely a turning point. And then, yeah, so I mean, you can imagine 2001 rolls around and I'm about to start a clerkship, and I was just like, nah, I can't do that.
Yeah. And then, yeah, you were saying Terror from the Red was coming out, and they just got even bigger and bigger. Plus,
Terror from the Red.
They got another record. And so how many people were in the Trustkill office altogether? Is it just you handling like the bulk, or did you have like help with like booking shows, you know, finding bands, doing any of the everyday office duties and stuff like that that a record label would?
So I never really got involved in booking tours. I had, you know, I worked with some agents early on. Probably the agent I would say Matt Pike from, what was it back then? It was Kenmore. But yeah, Matt Pike in the early 2000s picked up, you know, a bunch of my bands. And then Nick Storch picked up a bunch. So it was probably like Matt Pike and Nick Storch had the bulk of bands, and they were booking all the tours. And I wouldn't get too involved in that. I mean, I would make suggestions, but that was about it, or pick support bands or whatever. But yeah, I mean, let me think. 2002 is when I first hired someone. And it wasn't, it was actually, my friend Kyle and my friend Tim. I hired them really just to do mail order, because we had this web store, and I was doing mail order myself on top of everything else. So I hired those two guys to come in and do mail order. And then after that, it was, trying to think who came after that. I mean, you know, I only ever had five or six people in the office. In fact, I'll use the air quotes because I never had an office. I've always worked from home. Trustkill never had any office space. So, you know, everyone would come to my house and work, and I eventually got a sales guy, and I got a designer. I hired Chris Hansen, who does No Sleep.
No Sleep Records. Yeah.
And, but he started No Sleep when he was working for me in my basement.
Right. That's crazy that he still does that and that To Catch a Predator show.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Have a seat, please. I remember Dave. Was there Dave was like your.
So Dave Camo was my
business manager.
He was like my web guy. And he was working for me. So I met him in Syracuse, and he became one of my best friends, and he was in my band. And he was working for me unofficially, probably starting in like the mid. I mean, I registered trustkill.com. and built a website in, I want to say, 95 or 96. And he helped me register the .com and helped me build the original site. And then he would go on to develop everything about trustkill.com, and basically every idea I ever had, he brought to life, like Trustkill shows, which turned into killer tours. And we had a mobile company called Mobile Threat that he coded. And he coded our message board and our web store and everything. So he was great. And he worked.
Yeah, you were one of the early web adopters, at least in the music scene. I think that really helped Trustkill take off as well.
We had videos up on our site, like little QuickTime samples, long before any other label was doing that. Thanks to Doug Spangenberg, who would eventually end up filming the Hellfest.
Yeah, I was gonna say High Roller or something, right?
He would start High Roller, yeah. And then did some music videos for me for Brother's Keeper and This Is Hell. I mean, at the peak, Trustkill had maybe five or six people in my basement. I had a bunch of interns. And then, yeah, that was about it.
Some redheaded chick who was always in the artwork.
Redheaded chick. Oh, yeah. Ex-wife.
That's a... I didn't want to... I wasn't... Honestly, I didn't even... I figured she was, but I never really knew who she was. Yeah. I just assumed it was your, you know, significant other at the time. Yeah. But then she mysteriously vanished, never to be heard from again.
So much you had to think about it for a little bit.
Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah.
Yes, the sorry one that I that spent a long time with.
But I want to say, sorry, Dave, I just want to say two things about that time period. The first is I must thank Josh, as he was one of the first people that sort of gave me any attention whatsoever when I launched this new website. I do remember, you know, reaching out to a bunch of labels. Some were receptive, some weren't. I can still remember Jade Tree basically told me to go away, as did like Magic Bullet and a few others. Hydra Head was cool. They sent me a bunch of stuff, but Josh sent me a bunch of stuff and
literally, I guess,
what's that?
Everything behind you right now?
Well,
I
bet this Walls of Jericho came from there and probably opposite December, but the rest came later. I have more, you know, this was like my basement's a mess, but this was like, you know, 5 minutes of seeing what I had lying around.
Yeah, I should probably explain, like you're in front of like a display of posters and memorabilia that have to do,
well,
I'm assuming
it's
with
just
Josh's
a whiteboard thing that I threw like magnets up. But yeah, we got Brothers Keeper here. Anybody who's anybody remembers Mike Ski getting stabbed. And we got Tear from the Red and the Vanity, although this is a Good Life production, the Vanity picture disc. And
is that the other Trustkill?
Oh, this
DVD?
Is a Trustkill World.
Nice.
Video Assault.
Yeah, and, that's another Doug Spangenberg production.
He was all over the place back in the day, though. I remember seeing his name everywhere, it seemed.
The unopened Trustkill Takeover Volume 2.
That's got a 16-month calendar in it.
Ooh.
Oh, well, I should get on that.
Yeah. You should get on it. Probably a little out of
in any case, but I think one of the things that really helped get me started was an interview I did with you circa 2001. I just remember you put it on your homepage and like that was my biggest you put a link to Lambgoat and that was like my biggest day to that point and sort of got the ball rolling.
That's
so awesome. I was always appreciative for that. The second thing I wanted to mention was I think, you know, people look back and they think of the Poison the Wells and the Walls of Jericho and Throwdown, et cetera, et cetera. But it's important to point out that you released some really cool shit from some lesser-known bands, like Disembodied and Burn It Down, and who's the other one that?
Bad Life or Blue Eyes?
No, I wasn't going to mention them. there was another band that I wanted to point out.
They got Most Precious Blood. No, Most Precious Blood.
Yeah, they have Most Precious Blood. And
Nora was on there.
Indecision, of course. Nora. Turmoil.
I never released any Indecision stuff.
Sorry. Most Precious Blood.
Just to be clear,
But Turmoil was the band I was trying to...
Turmoil, Process.
They had Shai Hulud on there. This Is Hell, yep. Terror. Hope's Fall.
Yeah,
you know, you did a couple other things that were outside of the hardcore realm for the most part, but still kind of within the vein of.
I want to say
those came a little.
I call it hardcore adjacent.
Yeah, but I mean, he was one of them that were putting them out. You know what I mean? Like, where else were you gonna find some kind of stuff like that? It just seemed because like out of the labels that we'd already mentioned, like Hydra Head and some other smaller Equal Vision, some smaller ones. And I could be completely wrong because it just me and my friends were listening to this music at the same time. But it felt like Ferret and definitely Trustkill were in the forefront, you know, for labels that kind of handled that type of music. So it was cool.
Yeah,
to
I mean, it was
expand their roster.
Trustkill and Ferret were kind of obviously always interlinked because you know, Josh and Carl were good friends, and they kind of blew up around the same time. I like Josh, got a lot of mileage out of Boys in the Well from Auto Nash. It's really helped Ferret blow up. And the other label, well, I mean, in addition to, when I think back to that time, I also think of Eulogy Recordings and
I mean, there's like
Equal Vision, Revelation Records. But I think like Eulogy, Ferret, and Trustkill in my mind sort of encapsulate that scene.
Agreed.
Now, Eulogy never blew up to the degree that, you know, Ferret and Trustkill did.
Agree.
But whatever.
It might be because Evergreen Terrace is from here, and it just seemed like Eulogy, because they were on Eulogy at the time. It just seemed like Eulogy was a smaller label compared to
the
two.
Yeah, they were.
I mean, but they are vitally important in, you know, their role is vitally important to the hardcore scene, too. So I didn't want to discredit them, but...
No. Well, they had Set Your Goals, so that was probably one of their biggest releases.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not on the level of, you know, Bullet for My Valentine or... I don't even know. What's the biggest Ferret release?
Every Time I Die.
Yeah, I was going to say. Wait. Ferret release.
Yeah. What was the last album Ferret, or Every Time I Die put out?
Devil Ferret. Wears Prada, Every Time I Die.
Oh, the Devil Wears Prada. Shit, I forgot about them. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And they put out the, what was the oddball? God, I can't remember anything anymore.
what year?
In Flames. They put out an In Flames record.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Come Clarity.
Oh, yeah. that was a really good one, in my opinion, I should state. That was a really good one.
Exactly.
I like that one.
Has my favorite In Flames song of all time on that record.
Which one is
that? That is...
I want to say it's the first track. I can't remember the title, but it was on Guitar Hero.
Oh, okay. I liked the Clarity one, Come Clarity. That was like the big video song they had at the time.
Yeah.
I just remember at the time that was such, sorry, Dave, but I was just going to say, it was such an oddball release, like Ferret putting out In Flames.
It was. I mean, they, you know, Carl really went out on a limb to put that record out. I mean, the band was, you know, pretty hot at the time, selling a lot of records in the States. And they just finished their contract with Nuclear Blast and were shopping around, and they wanted a really big advance. I know, because I was negotiating with them as well, and I got to a point where I was like, nah, I'm good. But, you know, Carl kept going and wrote them a really big check, and, you know, the record was great and was a big success, but I don't know, you know, in hindsight, if he would have done that again.
What are some of your biggest misses as far as, like, bands and records you didn't, like, bands you didn't sign, records you didn't put out?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Is it a long list or a short list?
You want me to talk shit? No, I mean, you know.
No, I shouldn't say regret. You just regret missing out on putting them out. Not that you're necessarily talking shit about a band that you put out a record for.
Yeah, well, like some records I put out that didn't, you know, that didn't sell as much as we wanted to or whatever, but... But yeah, I got an email from Josh from A Day to Remember when they first started, and he was like, "Man, I love Trustkill, and we just all we want to do is be a Trustkill band." And I just didn't love the music, or I didn't follow up, or I don't know. But so I missed that one.
New phone, new diff.
Yeah. And they're, you know, one of my favorite bands. Who else?
Did Fall Out Boy ever call you?
Fall Out Boy. So, funny story. I signed Race Traitor in the late 90s, which was Pete Wentz's hardcore band from Chicago.
Andy was in there too, right?
With Andy Hurley, yep. So it was Andy and Pete Wentz and this guy named Money. And yeah, great band, loved them, was all excited to do a second record. The band quickly broke up. And then Pete and Andy went and started Fall Out Boy. And I found out a year or two later that Pete never sent me a demo because he didn't think I liked pop punk.
Mm.
Which is weird because I love pop punk. And the first couple Trustkill releases were pop punk releases. So I don't know, but whatever. You know, I wasn't mad at them. Obviously, they went and, you know, blew
up. Well, you know, it didn't. Was it Undecided Records that released that first Fall Out Boy?
No, it was not Undecided. It was Uprising. Close.
Mm. Uprising.
Uprising. Sean.
Seven Vegan. Angels, Seven Plagues. Shit.
Sean Wegenreich put that first record out, and I remember, and I loved it, and yeah, I was bummed, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Well, my point was it didn't really work out for them, the label. So, I mean, it might have worked out temporarily, but it didn't guarantee any sort of longevity or mass fortune. So I guess you didn't miss out.
That's hard, man. I mean, look at a label like Eyeball from New Jersey. They had My Chemical Romance and Thursday.
Mm.
And you think that should have propelled that label to stardom, and it didn't. So, you know. There's no guarantees.
Yeah, well, Thursday, I think, became a bigger band later on. You know what I mean? After they kind of probably went away for a little bit, I think people were like...
When they went to Victory.
Speaking of that, I guess I should just touch on there's many, I guess, people that have negative things to say about their record label that they work with, whether it be your record label, Victory, or any other record label that is out there in the world, per se. How do you, like, deal with that with, like, you know, whether they be bands, if they have the right to say something or they just want to talk shit? How do you deal with, like, the negative feedback from, you know, people that you had on your roster? And how does it affect, like, when you're looking for new bands, new artists? Or like, how does it affect your new label going forward, you know?
That, you know, it sucks when... business doesn't necessarily work out the way you want it to work out. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a music business. It's not a music friendship. So when there's money involved and everyone has to pay their rent, you know, things can happen. But, you know, I try not to take things too personal, you know, like, I mean, anyone who knows me or what I've done for my bands knows that I always make the best effort and try to, you know, do what's right for the band and the record and the music and the guys in the band. And when things go south, I mean, that sucks, but you know, I do what I can do and we move on and, you know, try to make things happen for the next band. Mm. But you know, I don't know. I guess that's
I mean, I think we'd be remiss if we, you know, didn't. There's been not lately, because obviously Trustkill isn't a thing, but there was some shit talk between, you know, Hope's Fall was one of the more vocal shit talkers, I'll say, for a lack of eloquent way to put it. We talked to Chris Hornbrook, you know, in one of these episodes. He didn't have anything to say about Trustkill, but I know, you know, he was probably not a Trustkill, you know, he wasn't president of the fan club down the road. And I've gotten phone calls from Rob Fusco where he just made it clear he wasn't a fan. And I mean, if you ask me who the most notorious record label is, as far as, I don't say mistreatment, but basically, you know, relationships ending badly, it's obviously Tony Brummel of Victory Records. And I'm not putting Trustkill in that category at all, but, you know, there have been it does seem like a few of those relationships have soured and, you know, people might say, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. I guess, why did you have, you know, falling? I don't mean to put you on the spot. I just don't want to be one of those people that, like, hey, you're the best, everything's perfect. thanks, Josh.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, why?
It was.
Were they mostly? I assume they were mostly. It's always money. So I'll just assume, you know, the root of all those things is financial.
I mean, some of it is, some of it isn't. I mean, I remember, you know, the Hope's Fall situation was weird because, you know, by the time I put out their third album, actually fourth album, Magnetic North, Jay Forrest was the only guy in the band. The whole band had, I don't know, quit, got kicked out. I don't know what happened, but you know, Jay was the only guy left, and you know, we tried really hard to like get them out on tour and support the record, and it was, you know, it was tough. But one of the things I remember that Hope's Fall complained about was that I took a song off the album and used it as a B-side for Japan. And I remember at the time being like, that's so weird because we did the same thing for your last two albums. And we told you, you know, like we had communication and emails with their managers and we're like, look, you know, we can't release this record in Japan if we don't have a bonus track. That's just how things were done back then. And I don't know where the miscommunication was, but, you know, most likely it was managers not relaying the proper information of the band, and the band all of a sudden gets surprised by something that they shouldn't have been surprised by. And I mean, yeah, Hope's Fall, you know, their first album came out Satellite Years, and we sold, I don't know, 50,000 copies, I want to say. I don't really remember, but it was huge. It was a smashing success. And then A-Types was the follow-up record, and it didn't really do as well. And by the time Magnetic North came out, you know, the band and the managers were like, well, we got to ship 50,000 records. And I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Things really fell off. Data retail was bad. And, you know, we got hit with tens of thousands of returns, which, of course, makes a band not recoup. So, yeah, it was, you know. There's a lot of issues. As far as Most Precious Blood is concerned and Rob Fusco, that's a weird one because I don't really know why he's so mad, and no one in his band does either.
Let's say breaking that news to you. You knew that? No. Or, okay. I wasn't sure. I was like, maybe he's just punking me. But I mean, I haven't talked to him in a while, but it was like he talk about you and his problems with you. Yeah. And I don't remember what they were. It was just, this dude definitely doesn't like Josh.
When they, sorry. I'm getting One King Down and most. So, Most Precious Blood played This Is Hardcore with Rob on vocals, and Rob said something about me on stage, and I was like, what? And then we're in the parking lot after the show, and the band was like, dude, we have no idea what Rob is talking about. We have no idea. We don't understand. You know, and basically the band was like, you know, I don't want to say anything, but the band basically was like, we don't understand what he's so mad about. And I just, you know, rubbed it off, whatever. The next year, This Is Hardcore, was it last summer? Was it One King Down was last summer, right? Yeah. And I'm backstage and I see Rob and he goes, dude, what's up? And shakes my hand and it's like, we're bros. And I was like, well, that's weird. Didn't you talk some shit on stage a year ago? I don't know. But whatever. I mean, you know, I have nothing against him other than he has something against me that I don't know about. And the band doesn't really understand. So I just shook his hand and was like, what's up, dude? And that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, I never really understood what... I mean, he probably explained it to me and I just don't remember.
But, I don't know. I mean,
it doesn't matter.
If I'm going back to the last Most Precious Blood album cycle, which is now, we're talking 10 years ago, but the band had started on the Do Not Resuscitate album, and it was supposed to, you know, the process went from taking, you know, 2 months to 2 years. And I actually kind of forget all the reasons why the album took so long, but I know, you know, Justin had some health issues and then his job, and, you know, they were all scattered about, and I don't really know what happened, but, you know, Rob's doing vocals somewhere else. The band wasn't even aware that he was starting vocals, and it was this very weird way to make an album, and it came out very late. And I don't know what the problem was necessarily with the album release, but who knows?
Oh, fuck it. I don't mean to drag you down this manhole.
What's the big deal here?
Television turned on.
My TV just turned on.
That was awesome.
Great timing. Yeah, but they I guess we should have brought it up, or we had to bring it up, just because it's still going on. Just because,
that's what I do.
Yeah, that it's all also good. We're Lamb Goat, but there's a couple
I'm
different
by it too.
There's a couple different bands that have cited issues with the label, and, you know, if someone were to Wikipedia you or the label or whatever, it'd be on there. So people would yell at us we didn't bring it up, but I know we could talk about. We could talk about Trustkill and all that stuff forever.
Well, I just.
But do you have anything else, Alex? That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, okay. I do. sorry. There was one other thing that, you know, I obviously you got Bullet Tooth going on now. So I want to get there, but and not have this be 3 hours long. now I forgot what was good. Oh, so for everybody that doesn't know, well, actually. Here's a quiz for you, Dave.
Okay.
What do you think the three biggest Trustkill releases in terms of sales were?
Good question.
Oh God, I just looked at the
And I know the answer circa 2013. Josh can correct me.
I'll go ahead and try to throw them out there. And again, I'm basing it off of the roster that I'm looking at, and I'm trying to kind of okay. I would say,
I would assume
Poison the Well. Poison the Well would have to be in there. Well, no, I'm trying to like guess, but I'll go with Poison the Well, 18 Visions, and that Hopes Fall record.
0-3. Congrats!
Ah, nice. It's probably like Bullet for My Valentine.
You said Poison the Well. That's one of them.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Yeah, but that wasn't in 2013.
Oh, in 2013.
I'm not asking you to say 2013. I'm just saying that's the last time I had like an actual definitive list with album sales.
Yeah,
I know it's changed since then.
And Poison the Well hadn't been on that label for a while, right? In 2013. When did they leave Trustkill?
Well, no, I'm saying these were sales tallies up until 2013.
Okay. Yeah, I can't imagine much has changed since then, but...
Yeah, well, I'll just say, in 2013, number one was Bullet for My Valentine, The Poison, and I guess sales, straight from your mouth, was 665,000. And I can't imagine there's been a bigger Trustkill seller than that.
Nothing even came close.
Right. Number two was Bleeding Through, This Is Love, This Is Murderous.
Wow,
143,000.
That is impressive, because I was going to say that, but I was like, nah, this is only me and my friends were jamming that. But then, yeah, that was a big record for them. Impressive. Go ahead.
And number three, again, in 2013, was also Bleeding Through, The Truth, with just short of 100,000.
Wow.
Now, at the time, Tear from the Red was... 82,000, and The Opposite of December was 80,000. So I guess that's changed.
I don't know. I haven't looked at...
Or maybe just lied to me in 2013.
I haven't looked at those numbers in a while. I mean, that's mostly accurate, but I would say Poison the Well, The Opposite of December would be in there, probably right under Bleeding Through.
I would say a lot of...
Number four was Throwdown, Haymaker.
Okay,
and
so
five was
I'm close.
It Dies Today.
I'm close. I almost said It Dies Today too. God, I'm pretty close.
Yeah, probably four, five, and six would be Throwdown Haymaker, It Dies Today, The Caitiff Choir, and Bleeding Through the Truth.
Jeez, all those. I mean, outside of, I'm not a Bullet for My Valentine fan, so I didn't really ever listen to them. But like, damn, all those other records are like so pivotal. You know, or I don't know, but well, I wouldn't want to say pivotal, but damn, those are from bands that, you know, kind of all this is built on for the most part now.
Yeah, bands like Hope's Fall and Walls of Jericho.
Second tier sellers.
Oh, and Terror. All those bands like did great, sold tens of thousands of records, but just not, they didn't get up to, you know, 75,000, 100,000.
Yeah, Bullet for My Valentine. I wouldn't. That blows my mind that it was over 500,000 sales because just first. I mean, your label, again, no disrespect, was a smaller label, but I mean that band at the time. I mean, I heard them on Madden. You know, like they were on Madden for a while. This is probably after they left Trustkill a little bit.
No.
Oh, they were on.
No.
Yeah. I assumed
we got them.
That was like a.
That was 2005.
You had some deal. You know, that wasn't like a homegrown Trustkill band. No, you got the U.S. rights to release it or something.
Yeah. So this woman, Julie, in the U.K., signed them to her label, Visible Noise, who also had Bring Me the Horizon and The Lost Prophets, who were – big deal back then.
Not so much now.
Not so much now. So yeah, she had like those big three English bands, and she tried to get me to sign Bring Me the Horizon, and I wanted nothing to do with it. Regret that one as well.
Whoops.
But Bullet for My Valentine, I was like, yeah, like this is awesome. We can do something with this. And I remember I asked the 18 Visions guys, I was like, hey, you guys played with this band Bullet for My Valentine when you were in somewhere in the UK recently. Like, what'd you guys think? And they were like, man, don't sign those guys. They were terrible, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, you always got to take what got dudes and bands say with a grain of salt.
Yeah, they don't want to get outshined, you know, on their own label.
Yeah, so I ended up signing them. And yeah, it was huge. So... they were kind of within the Sony system in Europe. And then I took over for North America. And then after The Poison came out, I put out the Hand of Blood EP in 2005. And then The Poison came out February 14th, 2006. And then we did the Live at Brixton DVD. And then they were just much too big for me. There's nothing more I could do. They were selling too many records. The Poison sold over 1 million copies worldwide.
Now, did you actually make money on that release, or did you have to pay so much to sign them or to handle the release that it was kind of a wash?
No, I made money, but unfortunately that money stopped as soon as they went to Sony and a Jive. They were on Jive proper in the States. Now it's just Sony whatever, but we made money when it was happening, and then as soon as it was done, that was it.
Okay, and that leads me, so Trustkill ceased in what, 2010? 2010. All right. So, I remember at the time, or I vaguely recall that it was kind of a surprise. All of a sudden, it's like, okay, I'm no longer running Trustkill. I have this Bullet Tooth thing I'm launching. And I guess I was never clear, or if I was clear, I've since forgotten exactly what transpired there. And the same thing happened, I think more or less the same thing happened to Ferret, to the degree now where we have those two influential, iconic hardcore labels that are pretty much defunct entities. So if you could just clear that up quickly, I guess, without going too long. It was a deal where, or was it a case of you being in debt because you had overextended Trustkill and it was kind of a, you know, okay, I'll sell it for this amount of money so I can just, you know, alleviate that debt and walk away. What happened there?
No, so I originally signed with Sony in 2002. I was there to 2007 and then went to Universal from 2007 to 2010. During the Sony years, obviously a lot of shit happened and we sold a lot of records and we spent a epic ton of money on these records and the bands and the label. So when I made that move from Sony to Universal, I had to have Universal cut a big check to Sony to pay them off, which put me immediately in the hole at Universal. And then we spent the next 2 to 3 years trying to get out of that hole and sell records. Unfortunately, you know, the business was kind of falling off a cliff at that point. You know, record sales were plummeting. There was no streaming. Downloads were okay. But, you know, the business was just in a bad spot. And then you had the economic collapse and these big companies were tightening up checkbooks. And when the time came where they were no longer paying me, because it got to the point where they're like, listen, you're so under coops, we can't pay you. So even if you hit your projections and, you know, your next 10 releases sell exactly what you say they're going to sell, you're still not going to see a penny. So I couldn't, you know, pay my staff or pay my rent or put out records or do anything, really. I was pretty stuck. And I spent a good year and a half probably fighting with them and flying to LA with my lawyer and trying to work things out. And they had a new president who didn't give a shit about my company or my bands. He was a country guy and rap and just didn't understand what I was doing. And they basically just folded their arms and said, nah, we're good. We're just going to sell the catalog and that's it. So I had no choice but to just walk away from it and give them the catalog. And start.
So you had no
start from scratch. No, I didn't sell anything. At that point, it was already
somebody else's.
The catalog was completely devalued and worthless. We had, in the mid to late 2000s, we had shipped so many CDs to retail. You know, when a new release would come out, like let's say Bleeding Through the Truth would come out, we shipped probably 75,000 CDs and let's say 50,000 came back. I don't know. But we were getting hundreds of thousands of returns. As soon as, you know, the retail landscape was shrinking and Target and, you know, all these stores were not carrying CDs anymore. Those all got returned to Universal, which, you know, was a recoupable expense. So there was no money and there was no value and no one was buying the CDs and no one was downloading them. So it was valueless. So I just walked away and that was it.
So you walked away with no big check without ownership of the label you started.
There was no ownership and there was no, in fact, it was worse than that because everyone else I had deals with, right? So I had, you know, MerchNow was running my web store and we had deals with Revelation. Revelation was manufacturing vinyl and I had distributors in Europe. I was working with Plastic Head and Cargo and Shock in Australia and, you know, all these people that I had debts to as well. And when I started over, I didn't want to, you know, burn all these people that were friends of mine for 10, 15, 20 years, like a Steve Reddy at MerchNow. So long story short, I start Bullet Tooth and I have to work my way kind of back to zero with all these companies I had deals with. So like the first year of Bullet Tooth, I was selling records and merch through our web store to get my debt from Trustkill back to zero. So it was, it was really rough.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun. Well, the whole thing sounds horribly painful, and I imagine you've probably reconciled it a long time ago, but just having something that you built and
it sucks, and now it's
gone.
I've moved on and got a new thing. And
so who owns Trustkill now? Like, who actually owns it? Universal?
Universal owns the catalog, yeah.
Okay. So when Rise Records puts out Poison the Well reissues, they go to Universal?
They come to me, and I've been kind of like a liaison, and I'm working with Universal to make sure bands are paid and everything's up to date. And there's still so many problems with the Trustkill catalog for streaming, especially overseas. Because of all the expired license deals and companies that went bankrupt, like Shock and SPV in Europe and Roadrunner expired, and just, you know, all this stuff. So it's a giant pain in the ass, and I want these records up and available and, you know, get the artist paid. And so I've been trying to, you know, work with them. It's tough because it's like, these companies kind of change hands every year or two, and there's some new guy involved, and then they don't want to do something or whatever. But
why are you, and part of my confusion, why are you the liaison, or what if, you know, Universal owns Trustkill, why are you still
involved? Because they don't really know the bands, or they don't have the relations. So like,
do they bring you, do they pay you for your time?
No. But like, you know, Rise, right? So, you know, Matthew at Rise used to be in Roses Are Red on Trustkill. So he would come to me and be like, hey, we want to do this Poison the Well thing. And, or, you know, Equal Vision came to me and were like, hey, we want to release this Hope's Fall vinyl. And I'm like, all right. So I just like forward an email to whoever is, you know, the product manager at Universal, and we just kind of work something out and get it going. So, yeah.
Universal basically took that brand, whatever cachet Trustkill had, and just sat on it, did nothing with it.
Sat on it and did nothing with it, yeah.
Because I guess they have bigger things to focus on.
I don't think it's not their vibe.
From their perspective.
Yeah, it sucks. I mean, obviously, it's not how I wanted it to go. And, you know, Carl has similar things with Ferret. Like, they foreclosed on his label and took all the masters, and that sucks. I mean, it's a very similar situation.
Horrible.
Yeah. Well, so you started Bullet Tooth, and...
Can we skip into that? There's something else I'd like to...
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, so...
Go for it.
I've had a question, and I've wanted to know what happened, and we've talked kind of about the festival already, but Hellfest was also a big cornerstone, I think, for, I don't know, man, not just hardcore in general, but it was a festival before festivals were a thing, you know, early 2000s. When we talk about Hellfest, we're not talking about the one in Europe. We're talking about the one you did in Syracuse for a number of years. And then the last one, I actually attended that one in Elizabeth, New Jersey at the Rexplex, and we were lucky enough. My band won some contest with Radio Takeover, and we got invited up there. We were like the fourth place band. We didn't get to play or anything, but we you know, what band?
Yeah.
Blink 182.
Yeah, no, I'll send it to you after this is all said and done. I'm not saying it on the podcast. But it was She Dies in December.
Clearly, you're very proud of that.
I mean, it is what it is. We had a cover song, and, you know, that was when Baby Got Back. You know, we had heard Baby Got Back, and so we did a cover song similar to that. But, one thing led to another, and we ended up at Hellfest, and that was one of the biggest... I mean, me and my friends still talk about that today, you know, because we drove up from, here from Florida to New Jersey. And like you said, people are flying in from all over the world to go to this thing. And it was like literally like an insane time. It was 3 days long, at least the one I did. It was 3 days long, like bands from start to finish. And it was like, the venue was crazy too. So it was like a whole thing that I think back on. But the next year, you were supposed to do it at Madison Square Garden, correct? In 2005?
Yeah. That was a Sovereign venue.
Oh, okay. I thought it was MSG, but...
Sovereign Bank.
Oh, okay. So let's... Hang on. Let's back up here. So, Hellfest... I didn't start Hellfest. Hellfest started in Syracuse by a guy named Keith Allen.
Who still pops up on the Lambgoat message board every now and then.
So Keith Allen started it. It wasn't even called Hellfest. It was called like Syracuse Fest in, I think, 97. And then 98, Anyway, 98, 99, it turned into Hellfest. I got involved in, I think, 98 or 99. And then 2000 was the big one I got involved in. And then 2001, 2002, and 2003 were in Syracuse. 2004, we brought it to New Jersey. After 2004 was done, that was when I decided I was done with Hellfest. And I didn't want to be involved anymore. My label was taking up too much of my time, and that was it. So I actually had nothing at all to do with Hellfest 2005.
You can't tell me why it fell apart.
I can tell you exactly why, but I'm just wanting to be clear here that
you weren't a part of it.
I was no part of it. Thankfully, because honestly, when that morning when we all found out it was being canceled, like I was psyched. Like we were in my basement about to start packing up the car.
Yeah, it was like right away, right? Like right before the
event. It was literally that morning. We were in my office. We were going to start packing up all the merch. It was a beautiful weekend. I remember I'm like, man, I really don't want to be inside this weekend. I'd rather just be at the beach or something. And I got a call from a booking agent. I think it was Tim Bohr or Nick Storch. One of them called me, or Jeremy Holgerson, and was like, yo, what is going on with Hellfest? And I'm like, I don't know. What is going on?
It was like an insurance thing, right? They didn't secure the insurance.
So supposedly Keith booked this venue in Trenton. I had never even seen it. I didn't know anything about it. It was a huge venue and supposed to get a $5 million life insurance, or I'm sorry, $5 million insurance policy for the venue, which is pretty standard and honestly not that much money, which he should have had from ticket sales. And I guess he got a $1 million policy thinking that was going to be good enough.
Yeah, I remember that now.
And when he showed up to the venue with the policy in his hand, they wouldn't unlock the gates. And they were like, no, we told you, it says in the contract, 5 million. We need 5 million policy or we're not opening the gates. And for some reason, he couldn't go get a $5 million policy. I have no idea why. Wow. And then the whole thing got canceled and it sucked. For like a few of my bands who were supposed to play. And it would have been a great weekend, but, you know, that was it. And a lot of bands got rerouted and played shows in Philly. It's a bummer.
Yeah, that was an epic, show, man. I think back and
2004 was fun.
Oh, yeah. And you know what's really big bummer about that festival, too? Not that festival, but, I mean, High Roller was doing the DVDs, and I was so psyched to, like, not only attend it, the event, but like later on I was going to be like, oh, I can't wait to get the DVD because I had the previous Hellfest DVDs too. And then here we are 2020, and I mean Sonny of Hate56 has the footage and he's slowly, you know, doing his thing with it, but like oh my god, I've been chomping at the bit to get some of those sets, you know.
Doug and Sean from Radio Takeover spent a lot of money and time filming 2004. And I don't really remember why they never finished or whatever happened, but I think shortly thereafter, Radio Takeover went under because of Hellfest 2005. That never happened.
I would assume so. Yeah, they were like a sponsor or something.
They were the main sponsor, heavily invested, and I don't know really what happened, but yeah, the fact that all that footage is going to start coming out is awesome. Did you watch Bad Luck?
You know what? That was the infamous like riot, and I did not. I was not there during that set. No, but I mean, I heard about it afterwards, and since then I've seen the YouTube videos and stuff, but I was probably too busy, like, on standing on one of those big-ass indoor hockey/soccer fields watching Under Oath or something like that, because that's one of the memorable sets, I guess, because they had just put out Chasing Safety, and I wasn't too sure how the community would take that record, you know, from, like, until the ones prior to that one, but... It stood out. And you know, they also had Drykill Logic was a band that played that festival, and I thought that was so weird because they were like a new metal band from, I guess, that area.
We started getting so weird. I mean, you know, the festival got big, and then all of a sudden it was like, all right, well, you know, you're talking to this one agent, and he's like, all right, well, you want this band, well, how about this band? And you end up starting to put on bands that kind of stick out a little bit. Like, I remember Life of Agony played 2004, and I just remember them, like, the band themselves being a bunch of pricks. You know, it's like you got all these, like, you know, young dudes and bands, like, It Dies Today, and everyone's so nice, and everyone, you know, it's like, it's, I don't know. And like, I went up on stage, and one of the guys in Life of Agony was just, like, a total prick, and I'm like, ugh, why do we even book you guys?
Well, I mean, props to the Drykill Logic thing. That was probably the only time I would have ever gotten to see them live. And by that time, I had somewhat moved on from nu metal. So to see them, me and my best friend, my current best friend Ian at the time, that was, like, so mind-blowing that they were there. So we definitely caught that set, even though I think it was, like, in a gym somewhere or some weird... That venue was... I tried to explain it to people, what the Rexplex was, I guess, at the time. But, like... There were birthday parties going on and some kind of weird second story situation, a paintball.
It was wild.
Yeah.
It was such a cool place.
Well, I think the takeaway is Keith fucked all that up, not you. You got out just in time.
I'm glad I was not involved in 05 because, yeek, that would have sucked.
You could have saved it.
Yeah.
You could have saved it.
I still see people asking him where the Hellfest money is. In any case.
I don't know what he did with it. I don't know why he didn't return kids' ticket money. Maybe he did. I don't know what the story is, but.
I don't even know.
I don't know.
I don't know. But, okay, so Bullet Tooth.
We had one of your bands on already.
Yeah.
You did. You guys had Minefield on. That was cool. I watched that.
And your ex-band, Memphis Mayfire, we had Maddie on.
Oh, nice. When was that?
Like our fifth one or something. Dave? Like way early on. I think it was like number five or six. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
About a year ago.
Selling his pomade or however you pronounce
pomade.
It.
Pomade.
Pomade? Is that how you say it? Someone told me the fancy proper pronunciation is, I don't know, maybe I'm just tripping right now.
Straight tripping, dog.
The Minefield guys are almost done with their album. I actually just saw the final cover artwork today for it. It looks sick.
Did they record it in Shed Sounds, or did they go to a studio? They went to a studio, no?
So I've heard demos, but I don't know if those are like the beginnings of the actual songs or if they're starting over from scratch. But yeah, they're doing it at Shed Sound. And songs sound awesome. It's heavy as balls and it's great. Love it.
Yeah, they're a great hardcore metal / crossover band. That seems to be all the rage currently, the crossover.
I mean, you know, if you know what I'm into, like, I've always loved that, you know, like the Marauder, Leeway, All Out War.
Freaking Master Killer, man.
Master Killer, all that shit is, you know. So, like, yeah, I heard Minefield, and I was like, fuck, these guys are awesome. I went and saw them play in front of, like, 10 people. It was awful, but the band ruled.
Yeah, we talked about that on their podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I'm used to it. I, you know, I signed a band once called Sick City from Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They were like a late 2000s Trustkill band. And I went and saw them play, and I was the only one there that saw them play.
Nice.
They came all the way down from Winnipeg to Asbury Park to play a show so I could see them. And I was the only one there.
They came from Winnipeg.
They drove from Winnipeg. Yeah. So I'm like emailing with these dudes, and I was like way into them. And I was like, hey man, you know, I'm way into this. I was like, if you guys are in the area, let me know. I'll come check you out. Thinking like, you know, whenever they're going to get a tour and be in New Jersey, they'll let me know. And like a month later, they're like, hey, we're playing Asbury Park this weekend. Come check us out. And I'm like, awesome. That was quick. So I went to see them play. And that's when I found out that they booked the show just for me to see them.
Oh, slick.
And I was like, oh, all right. But yeah, so I'm used to seeing bands play for nobody. It's fine.
Right, especially in this kind of genre, you know, there's the shows are kind of small.
Maybe that's the new world anyway. Bands playing for nobody.
Online.
When are we going to hear? Will there ever be new Earth Crisis?
Well, there ever, that is a great question. So, so the last Earth Crisis release was the New Ethic 7-inch and EP that I put out on Bullet Tooth, which was 2015, and it was four songs, two songs re-recorded from their first 7-inch and two songs re-recorded from their first demo that were never released. So that was cool, but not necessarily new music if you're a huge Earth Crisis fan, which I am, and I've always wanted new music. I've been bugging them for years. It's tough. They all live in different areas, and I don't know. They're not sure that people really, that their fans really want new Earth Crisis music, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I love all the newer stuff. But
you get into a situation where you feel like you're risking your legacy.
I think that's kind of where they are. They, you know, they still play, obviously, here and there, and like the California Takeover they just did, and they're one of those bands that kind of knows what their fans want, and they, you know, they have like a 45 minute to an hour long set list of songs that they have to play. Or people are going to get mad. So yeah, I don't know. I hope it happens. We'll see.
How about any new First Blood music ever coming?
First Blood?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably, yeah. I mean, Carl lives in Sweden, I think.
Yeah, it seems like all they ever do is play shows in Europe, and that's the existence.
Yeah, because Eve moved to Sweden a couple years ago, and yeah, I don't know. I wish they would tour the States so I could see him again, but...
Yeah, and I guess now that Justin is a big shot, Most Precious Blood is on ice, save for maybe an occasional This Is Hardcore appearance or something.
Yeah, and they played like Back to School Jam this past fall with Tom on vocals instead of Rob.
And when I say big shot, for anybody who doesn't know, he's a New York City councilman.
Yeah, I was saying he's a politician now. It's not a
big
good
deal
to be fronting the hardcore band, I don't think, unfortunately.
Yeah.
He doesn't hide his past, but yeah, he
can't be doing it currently, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, I would love new music from them, but I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, Bullet Tooth, I guess, as far as if you compare Trustkill to Bullet Tooth, just speaking of your schedule, it seems like, you know, Bullet Tooth's quiet. You're not working on Bullet Tooth 10 hours a day. Maybe you are, but I don't think you are. What are you doing with yourself these days?
No, I mean, you know, I used to put out 10, 12 records a year and hustle and, you know, work 12 hours a day, but I don't want to do that anymore. And putting out records is expensive. And, you know, so I, luckily with streaming revenue, the company's income is a little more stable than it was, let's say 5, 10, 15 years ago. Whereas, you know, in the 2000s, I was putting out dozens of records because I had to, and I had to maintain that overhead and just keep pumping out records. Where now there's revenue coming in from streaming on the whole catalog. So I kind of be a little more cheesy with the bands I'm working with. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't have to sign, but I can sign bands when I want. So like if I find something I like, you know, like Minefield or, you know, Death Ray Vision, those guys came to me and were like, yeah, we got this new band. I'm like, this sounds awesome. Let's do it. So,
So you're in a place of freedom, which sounds nice.
Yeah, it's a little more free. That's exactly what it is. So, you know, obviously I'm older now. I'm not in my 20s. I'm in my 40s. I don't want to work as hard. I got a 6-year-old and a wife, and, you know, I like snowboarding and mountain biking and going to shows and whatever else I like to do. But yeah, I'm not working on the label 10 hours a day anymore. You know, it obviously takes time, and putting out records takes a lot of time. I'm just not putting out as many.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I guess that brings us full circle. I had interviewed you when you launched Bullet Tooth in 2010. So obviously that's 10 years ago. And the last question of the interview was, when Lamb Goat interviews you in 2020, what will we be talking about?
Did I say something about, I remember that.
So here we are in 2020. I guess I'm just going to read your answer.
We planned that perfectly, huh?
I actually just thought of this during the interview. Jesus. I was like Googling, find this thing. But you said, I hope we will be talking about more successes with new bands and how kids appreciate music enough to pay for it. I don't know about kids paying for music. I guess they sort of do. It's just now they pay for Apple Music or Spotify.
Hey, I think kids these days are buying vinyl more than they did when
that's
I was
true.
A kid.
I mean, there's obviously that. But
if a kid can spend $10 a month on music, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, I hear you. As long as somebody's paying something.
Yeah.
And if, you know, some of these companies would actually kick a little more to the artist.
Well, they can't until kids want to pay more than $10 a month.
That's true. That's true.
So.
I don't even want to go down that road. I don't want to interrupt your answer. So,
hit us.
That is really all I can ask for. Maybe I'll also drive to the Lamb Goat office in my all electric car. Do you own an electric car?
I don't. No.
Well, hey, that's so much.
Kudos for the foresight to see that we would have not a prominent electric car, but we have an option.
That's true.
Sure. Got lots. Drive to the Lamb Goat office in my all electric car with the first female U.S. president in office.
Close.
Didn't happen. Unemployment at an all-time low. I guess maybe at the beginning of 2020, I don't even know where that stood, but now with the COVID thing, obviously,
he's at an all-time high. He must have been writing for The Simpsons or something.
Simpsons did it.
And no overseas wars. I guess that's kind of true. And but that may be too much to hope for in just 10 years. I think you were right on target there. I guess we've got to – we'll definitely have to sit down in 2030. Do you have any predictions for 2030 so we can discuss those and how wrong you were?
2030. Well, I hope we're all not sitting indoors in 2030.
No pandemic.
And that I can actually drive to the Lamb Goat office, the Lamb Goat high rise in Manhattan.
That'll be a good time, I think.
More like a cardboard box in Bed-Stuy, but. And 2030, we should be able to just like beam people wherever, right?
Yeah.
That's not too much to ask for in 10 years, so.
We'll do the Charlie's Chocolate and the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory thing.
Like disassemble and reassemble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, I always wanted to say, like, Lamb Goat to me, I look at Lamb Goat every single day for the last 20 years. It's my go-to news source. I love it. I've always loved what you've done with it. I love the podcast. It's awesome.
Hey, do you think that he should update the website, or should he keep it the 2000s?
I've waited so long to put a new website out. I'm like totally retro and don't classic. Ever change.
And it's like you waited so long. It's
coming back around.
The pendulum swung back.
Well, yeah, but you know how much abuse I take. Just that basically that the average message board user sums it up this way. I had a good thing going on in 2008, and I sat on my laurels and let it all turn to shit, and now it's just, well, it's shit. And I've got the same old website, and I don't put enough time into it. And, yeah, so I basically screwed it all up, which is fair. It isn't even my full-time job. But I do appreciate you coming for 20 years, and as I mentioned earlier, I owe some of my success, if you want to call it that, to you. So I appreciate that. And hopefully we'll both be in business in some respect with music in 2030. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
We can see what happens.
Yep. Awesome.
I would
thanks,
also,
guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. I would also like to say thank you as well. Without all your bands, I wouldn't have stole news from Lamb Goat early on and made my own website, and which was really weird when you texted me screenshots of like our old emails from freaking 2001, which was mind blowing, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I saved everything.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said to Dave. He's like, Josh had this this email from, when I was running a website. And that's pretty much my response. Once you've been in business a bit, you learn to save everything because you're going to need it. You're going to need to rip out that proof at some point.
Yeah.
If you emailed me or wrote me a letter since the mid-90s, I still have it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was like a 2001 email or something. It was crazy. And again, a lot of my traffic to my website came from, I think, that banner ad share that we had talked about in that email you sent me. So,
really?
Ooh, yeah. That's awesome. Banner ad shares, link exchanges.
Yeah, we were killing it. There was no money. I mean, like, again, there was no money being tossed around. I mean, you were a record label, so you probably had a tiny bit of money. But, yeah, as far as, like, there was no I'm sure you did it for the love back in the day, back in the early days. And then I was doing it for the love. I didn't get paid anything other than, like, your free care packages of CDs that I would receive for reviews and stuff like that. But other than that,
well, Trustkill paid Lamb Goat some money, Dave.
Ah, well, I didn't have a big enough website. My little puny HRN website wasn't as dominant. I had to steal the news from you. They weren't giving it to me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Now everybody I don't even want to go there. It's a lost art form getting news for hardcore metal. But yeah, I think, this is a great place to end.
All right, guys.
What should we be on the lookout for Bullet Tooth, other than we already said Mindfield is coming out?
Yeah, we got this Mindfield album coming out probably, I'm going to say, summer or fall. And I got a new album coming out from that band Throw the Fight from Minneapolis. That's coming out August 7th. And I got a new single coming out from that band Ritual from Canada, Matt from Dead and Divine's newer band. And some other stuff I'm working on.
Cool.
Oh, I totally forgot to ask. What are you listening to now?
Oh, shit. Love that new Drain record on Revelation.
Cool.
It's awesome.
Good album.
What else? The new story so far I like, or the new ish story so far. The newest 4 Year Strong.
I haven't heard that one yet.
What else?
If you dug that drain,
I don't want to
To what record?
If you dug that Drain record, there's another one, kind of not similar, but in the same kind of like punkish, you know, avenue. Verbal Razors just had one that was pretty damn good. And I'm not a big fan of that kind of sound, but those two records stood out to me the most from that like, genre. Question though, not to keep you on here a little more, but we just talked about, like you said, you're releasing a single. We had Frankie from Imure on here recently last week, and do you think the future of like hardcore, or I shouldn't say hardcore, but like bands, is releasing singles over a set period of time, or is it albums, like releasing full albums?
It depends on the band. You know, some bands probably don't need to be putting out albums. I mean, singles is fine. If you're, you know, I'm not, you know, most hardcore and metal bands should still be putting out albums. I mean, we love albums. We want to listen to an album from start to finish, you know, listen to why the band put those songs in the order they did. And we just want the package, and we want the vinyl, and we want the t-shirt, and we just want all that stuff that goes along with the album. But like, you know, pop bands and country crossover and you know, hip hop and things like that. I mean, I just don't see why you'd put a record out. I mean, Drake can put out a single every month and no one will really bat an eye. I mean,
mm-hmm. I was just curious as a label head, you know, like, what you may think the future would behold.
I love albums. I always want to do albums. I always want to do the physical release, whether it's a CD, a vinyl, a cassette, whatever the hell it's going to be. But I mean, at the same time, we now have the option where we can, you know, like with this Throw the Fight record, I mean, they're not really like a hardcore band. I mean, they're more like a hardcore adjacent kind of Warped Tour, you know, Octane kind of band, but you know, we have the ability to put out a full-length album from them, but also release a couple singles beforehand. And it's not, you know, we can do that with Spotify and Apple and Amazon, and I like that option, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious because, you know, it is what it is. The times change and streaming's a thing, and you know, physical sales. I mean, I'm one of the physical media kind of people, and I feel like a lot of older dudes like us in hardcore and metal, they are also like that. But like I said earlier, yeah, a lot of kids are starting to buy physical media too. So
I think hardcore metal dudes are, you know, we're not casual music fans. We're lifelong music fans that want to be involved with the band and learn about the band and know everything about it and wear the t-shirt. And that's not really, you know, your casual music fan who heard Trapped on the radio 20 years ago.
We can't get away from that. We're going to bring it up every damn episode.
I just, you know, it's my go-to.
Thank you. We almost went this entire thing without mentioning Trapped.
There's no reason a band like that needs to put an album out. Like, just drop a single. Your casual music fan is going to put it on their playlist, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And you survive and you live on playlists. There's no point in putting out a record.
I see that. I mean, yeah, and you make a good point as well, as just like this, fans of these genres act a little different than like fans of major music, you know, pop, hip hop, or I mean, and again, subgenres of music probably act the same, but obscure bands and stuff like that that people like, they do like to fully dive into. So,
yeah.
Well, Alex, do you have anything else before we cut Josh loose? It's been like
I'll see you in 2030, Josh. Well, actually, I'll probably see you on Twitter tomorrow. But hey,
we all should meet up for Furnace Fest. You know, the 40 year old dude hangout that's possibly going to happen in September.
If Furnace Fest happens, we'll be there. We'll have another podcast.
Yeah, I definitely will be there. I'm trying to talk Alex into making the trip to
Alabama. We'll just have to be like 10 feet apart and shit.
We got our hotel months ago.
Oof. I gotta get on it. I was kind of betting that the virus would take everything out for the year, but that's the one festival I was hoping doesn't get canceled.
Dude, Hopes Fall, 18 Visions.
Everybody.
Open Hand.
Yeah, I got into that band much recently, by the way. I picked up that
Open album. Hand.
Yeah, Open Hand. The first one you guys put out.
Pre-Seosin.
It was good. It was good shit. Well,
Well, fingers crossed for Furnace Fest, though.
Exactly. And Josh, thanks for
fingers crossed for any fest.
Yeah,
oh yeah, fingers crossed for humanity. I
fingers crossed for a crowd that Scott Vogel can stage dive into.
Fuck yeah, maximum stage dives.
Yeah,
worth it. Well, thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks for being flexible on our rescheduling, and we'll touch base again.
Hi, man.
Thanks, Josh.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.